So I'll start with an introduction and then move into the actual content of the report. attend a couple of apologies. Our director, unfortunately, is out of the office this week, so he's unable to attend. And our colleagues, Lieutenant Janchi, who the members of the bank finance will know, is unfortunately unavailable. Jeff is actually sitting on the short list for the content side for the bank committee, so good reason. Let's start with a note on terminology, because there's some confusion in this regard, and for the purposes of the report and the presentation, it'll be good if we just have that fun. In the report, we use the acronym FOE to stand for state-owned enterprise, but it's also been used to refer to state-owned entity. State-owned entities are a much broader category of organizations. They include national, provincial, and local entities. This is under the Public Finance Management Act schedule. So these range from constitutional institutions to water boards, museums, and large commercial entities. State-owned enterprises, by contrast, are legal entities created by governments and their commercial activities are going to be armed. And those will be the focus of this report. We use the term SOE also because it's consistent with the local and international literature. Other terms that members might come across are government business enterprise, which is used by the National Treasury, and major public entities, which is a term used in the Public Finance Management Act. It's important to note that within the group of enterprise entities referred to, the report does not look at development finance institutions. That's quite important because those institutions have very particular characteristics which were outside the scope of the report. So let me just start with a discussion of the typical role of state-owned enterprises, and that's in various countries, and then we'll get to specifics of the role of SOEs in Africa. So in countries with mixed or market economies, such as Africa, another question is why is state-owned enterprise necessary? So why is a conceptual backdrop here before we get into details? A number of common reasons are, the first one being market failure. So where the private sector doesn't undertake investment or production or some kind of activity that has social benefits to society, it may be worthwhile to establish a state-owned enterprise to promote that activity. One example is social housing, but there are many others. An alternative rationale is equitable access and affordability. So historically, a major reason for establishing SOEs in a variety of countries has been ensuring universal access to critical services and infrastructure. An important early example was postal services. A third common reason is natural monopoly. So where an industry inherently supports the existence of only a few enterprises, it can be quite difficult to manage those enterprises if they're privately owned in the public interest. So an alternative approach is for governments to actually own those enterprises, own the monopoly entity, and ensure that rather than maximizing monopoly profits, they rather maximize the social benefits. A good example is rail infrastructure. A lot of rail infrastructure is inherently monopolistic. It's not economically viable to build parallel rail infrastructure. So the result is that there's a danger.
So I would request that while we continue to make presentation, let that be sort of an important part.
Thanks for your attention. Could the committee secretary just check that? The final common reason for establishing SOEs is strategic significance, and that includes identifying the relevance to national security or securing supply of critical resources such as water. These are often referred to strategic and safe under state ownership. These are what I might call textbook reasons for establishing SOEs. So across countries with mixed funds. Later on in the presentation, I'll talk about the role of state-owned enterprises in developmental states, which deviates a little bit from these reasons. Okay, so that's just some conceptual background. To give the members of the Portfolio Committee on Public Enterprise some background to the origins of this report, the terms of reference were derived from a particular statement in the 2014 medium-term budget policy statement by the Minister of Finance, specifically these three. The first was that the National Treasury would be developing a new framework for funding state-owned companies that will distinguish purely commercial activities from the cost of exercising their development mandate. Second, that state-owned companies should operate on the strength of their balance sheet. And third, the capitalization of SOEs will only be funded by the sale of non think is very relevant for this framework and the revenue hurdle, which Scott is responsible conducting oversight over. That's one part of the background. But another important part of the background is that in 2012, the Presidential Review Committee on State-Owned Entities finalized a major report into the role of SOEs in the South African economy and state, and made various recommendations in relation to their functioning and financing. The PRC report identified three phases of SOE policy in South Africa, the first being privatization, second being restructuring, and the third, rationalization. And that record is much a description of the proposal, because in many respects, the phase of rationalization is actually supposed to follow from the recommendations made in the PRC report. A significant component of that report dealt with governance issues. It's important to note that this is largely outside of the scope of the CBO's report. So our interest is primarily in the public finance aspect. Of course, members will be well aware that governance affects the financial status of SOE, but nevertheless, it's not within the scope of this report. Another important component of the PRC report was the recommendation that governments should periodically review and balance social, political, and economic priorities of SOEs. And that comes back to why do we actually have SOEs in existence? Besides those textbook reasons I just described, there are also other considerations related to developmental state jobs, that's next. As an administrative process, the PRC recommended that a transitional SOE reforms committee be established, and an SOE Council of Ministers also be established to take forward recommendations. There have been some statements recently by the Minister suggesting that this process is taking place, but at the time of producing the current report, there was no information in that regard. Another important high-level recommendation of the PRC report was the passing of an SOE Act based on the existing draft Government Shareholder Management Bill, which was actually drafted in 2008. Based on the information PBOD has obtained, the Minister is intending to table the report before the Portfolio Committee on Public Enterprises in financial year, but members of that committee may be more aware of recent information. Finally, just to say, some of the important recommendations from the PRC that are relevant, for current reports, are dealing with government and so on, are the following. First of all, the need for a consolidated funding framework for commercial state-owned enterprises or state-owned companies and development finance institutions. So that's very much consistent with the statement made by the Minister of Finance and HCPS. The PRC also recommended a revised approach to what it calls non-financially viable commercial state-owned enterprises. It focuses quite a lot on the role of economic regulation, successes, failures, and alternative approaches. It largely endorsed SOE self-financing by raising debt off their own balance sheets, again linking to the statement made by the Minister of Finance. And finally, it encouraged the use of private financing to support state-owned enterprises, with a few caveats, which I'll get to later. So it's important to mention the PRC report, honourable members, because a lot of research was conducted for that. It was in many respects more comprehensive than the report CBO has been able to produce. And members who are interested in some of these details would go and read that report if you're interested. So to get to the current report, our terms of reference follow very directly from the statement made by the Minister of Finance and the recommendations of the CRC report. So our report had four components. The first was to research the role of state-owned enterprises in a developmental state in South Africa. The second was to look at the separation of commercial and developmental mandates to state-owned enterprises. The third was to look at alternative approaches to deciding the extent of state financial support to SOE. And finally, considering factors relevant to determine whether state assets are in fact non-core and can be sold to raise revenue as proposed by the Minister in the 2014 NCPS. One point particularly important to emphasize, just in terms of expectations, is that detailed analysis of any particular enterprise is outside the scope of the report. We do use some illustrative examples because I think it's quite helpful to consider a particular enterprise when talking about a certain type of financing issue, but we haven't gone into detail on any particular enterprise. Further work on particular SOEs is possible, and in fact, in this regard, I think it's important for these two committees to note that we have received a request from the Standing Committee on Appropriations.
I have got a request from the candidate to buy it. She's very shy.
Well, she can't speak for herself, so I'm a spokesperson. So she said that you're agree with her, but obviously she's growing confidence. And then she would hopefully ask, well, what about she needs to be in the government's committee by the end of 2017? Can we be able to speak for her?
Thank you, sir. Thank you, honourable member. If there are any such issues, better to work from the beginning so I don't get to the end and find out. But I need to work on this. Thank you. So, the point I was making is the detailed analysis of any enterprise outside the scope of the report. We have received a request from the Standing Committee on Appropriations to look further into ESOM's finances because we produced a presentation for that committee on the special appropriation bills relating to ESOM. This touches on an issue that we raised later in the presentation report, just for coordination among parliamentary committees, because obviously that's kind of an out relevant to both these committees. Okay, just to give you a sense of our information sources, most of the information we use is really second-hand information, secondary sources using existing literature and so on. We did try to obtain some primary data, and that largely wasn't successful for two reasons. So the data that's created for the PLC report, which housed, we have been told, with the Human Science Research Council. And that database is supposed to be updated, and that hasn't happened. As we understand, it's due to problems between the PRC, the HSRC, and National Treasury, but that limits the data available to us. Second of all, we obtained some useful policy documents from National Treasury and some aggregate data on SRE finances, but we weren't able to get detailed data on SRE balance sheets, and in particular, data on state assets wasn't provided. So as you'll see, that kind of limited the analysis we could conduct on the question of non-core state assets. What that also means is the report is relatively light on numbers, which is sort of a budget office that I'm entirely used to. We're economists and accountants, we like working with data on numbers. But actually, we believe the report is still fairly useful because it deals with a lot of conceptual issues without which it's not really very sensible to go into a numerical or financial analysis. But there were some constraints in terms of accessing data, and the relevant committees might want to consider those issues for future work. So just to get into the contents of the report. So the first aspect is relatively high level. We looked at the role of state-owned enterprises in developmental states and relied on existing literature in that regard. That's important because the current policy framework in which SOEs operate is based on the notion of a developmental state. I think it's important to note that as a parliamentary budget office, we can't consider the merits of different layers of policy. So considering the functioning of state-owned enterprises and their financing, we need to locate them within the broader policy framework. In the current context, the broader policy framework is that of the developmental state. It informs the National Development Plan. It also informs the Presidential Review Commission's report. So the main point about developmental states is that governments play a central and active role in the process of economic development. One can contrast that with the notion of regulatory state, where government instead focuses resources on regulating private sector activities. Now, this is obviously particularly relevant to state-owned enterprises. Because state-owned enterprises exist because states taken the decision that it's better in particular sectors for governments to own developing enterprises rather than have them owned by the private sector and regulated by government. So, in some respects, that is a very good example of a decision to pursue a developmental state over a regulated state. There are some characteristics of successful developmental states that have been identified in the literature. Included among these are an ability to plan, coordinate, and implement steps to achieve vision for economic development, which requires technical capacity and competence, an ability to establish social compacts, and avoiding capture by partisan interests. For the purposes of SOE financing considerations, it's important to think about the additional role that SOEs play in developmental states over and above the technical examples we gave before. But notably, federal enterprises provide a potential lever for government influence or direct economic activity. Among the expectations of federal enterprises that might go beyond their more traditional roles are investing in economic infrastructure, promoting industrial policy, and increasing competitiveness of the economy. Those motivations potentially encompass much more involvement in the economy than are justified by the market failure rationale for establishing SOEs that's used in non-developmental states. Okay, moving on to the second component of the report, and this is probably one of the two lengthiest components of the full report, remember. statement by the Minister of Finance or statements in the media talking about the policy statements, the government's proposing a new framework for funding state-owned companies that will distinguish really commercial activities from the cost of exercising developmental mandates. So here we can link to developmental states. So I want to define what a non-commercial mandate is. A non-commercial mandate is anything that an entity does or is expected to do that would not be expected of a private company in the same industry or situation. So this also means that a country relative, because depending on how the state regulates the private sector, that will also determine what actually constitutes a non-commercial mandate. Some typical examples across countries are expanding access to services, providing affordable services, investing in infrastructure that has wider social and economic benefits, and even providing or generating employment. So when it comes to expanding access to services, a good example would be the National Electrification Program. In terms of providing affordable services, that would be providing low-cost electricity to indigent citizens, for example. Investing in infrastructure has wider social and economic benefits. It could be anything from building an airport in an area where the economic returns can justify a private company building airports, rehabilitating railway stations or anything similar. It doesn't justify purely on a profit basis. In the platform context, we could also add skills development, preferential procurement, and small business development, all of which are typically expected of state-owned enterprises, but not always expected in the same way of private operators. And important thing to point out is that because non-commercial mandates could be anything that a public entity does that a private entity wouldn't do, that also includes things that public entities shouldn't be doing because of vested interests or weak governments that arise from them being public entities. So the tax dollar by the court notion, but that's not typically the kind of thing we'll look at from a client's perspective. So again, as I said, we don't go into detail now to particular enterprises, but it's useful to focus the mind on some topical issues that have come up in recent times. So for example, with ESCOM, it's being claimed by managers within ESCOM, commentators, analysts, and so on, that some of these factors constitute non-commercial mandates that affect ESCOM's finance. So one example is delayed maintenance. The claim has been made on delayed maintenance for public interest reasons, which led to costs further down the line, use of diesel turbines, straight costs. If that's true, that would be a non-commercial mandate, because it's done in the public interest, not necessarily something that a private enterprise has done. Non-collection of municipal debt, inadequate tariff increases, empowerment requirements in the cold supply chain, and expansion of access. So what I was referring to previously, the electrification program. Now, the fact that something is non-commercial mandate isn't problematic. The fact that something is a non-commercial mandate is not in itself problematic. But from a financing point of view, of course, later, if it has significant financial implications, it's going to affect the financial status of an enterprise. And if it's not funded, then the enterprise will potentially have a negative financial status, but for reasons that are not necessarily eventful. So in the report, we don't endorse any of these claims, but we're putting them out there because they have been made and they are quite relevant to the financial sector, so if the enterprise is considered.
I think that allowed them to look so that we don't need to so that we don't need to have to the instrumentation. Thank you and honorable time.
Obviously, I look you to take questions on. We're happy either way to take questions afterwards or during, whichever you think is appropriate. Another example in relation to African Airways was the claim that African Airways was operating international routes, for example, to China, that were loss-making, but they were doing this in order to generate tourism for the country. So that's a classic example of something that you might expect a state-owned enterprise to do. It's supposed to as a positive externality. So SAA might operate a route to a particular country. It's not making for SAA, but the net effect on the country might be to increase GDP beyond whatever it costs SAA. So in that case, it might be socially beneficial, but the problem is that SAA is still going to be making a loss. Of course, from the state's point of view, the question is, does it actually lead to a net gain or not? So as I say, outside the scope of the report to assess these claims, there's obviously important for assessing SOE finances that these issues get taken into account, and that's really the context in which the issue should be raised by the National Treasury. So, Chairman, if you went direct attention to a few parts of the report, one of them would be this diagram. This is a very useful way of summarizing what the factors are that Science Today. The reason we were asked to produce this report, the reason why Parliament is particularly interested in the financing of SOE and the efficacy or non-efficacy of that, is because of the financial status of many state-owned enterprises at the moment. So the first part of the diagram, just without any colors in it, shows standard factors affecting the financial status of a commercial enterprise. So that's where we start off if we want to think about non-commercial matters. Start off with thinking about how a private enterprise can operate, and then bring in the additional considerations related to their enterprise. So for a standard private sector enterprise, you have operational expenditure, investment expenditure, investments by shareholders in the form of equity, revenue from operations, and then loans either from shareholders or just from financial markets. Where things get interesting is when you find that the financial status of a private enterprise where you can attribute that to a failure of something in the diagram, whether it's poor performance on the revenue side, loss of customers, inappropriate pricing, or you know, inefficient operations or investment expenditure. With SOEs, there is, for a start, the additional consideration on commercial mandates. So when you observe that an SOE has a poor financial status, the question is not just these other standard factors, but also what is the role being played by non-commercial mandates? For example, when it comes to, say, operational expenditure and investment expenditure, if those are too high relative to what the enterprise is achieving, is it because of inefficiency, is it because of poor management, or is it because the enterprise is being asked to pursue non-commercial mandates that's not being compensated? So that's a problem for oversight, because how do we know why these enterprises are not performing as might expect? What often happens, not just in South Africa, but in any other countries, is that non-commercial mandates are implicitly funded. So in other words, the state doesn't say enterprise, this particular enterprise must conduct a certain activity and how much will pay you for it. It does other things. So the state might, for example, reduce earning expectations from the particular enterprise. If the enterprise only produces a billion rand profit, where it might previously have been expected to produce 5 billion rand profits, the state shareholder might say, well, we can understand why that might be the case because we know you're pursuing some non-commercial mandate. Alternatively, the state, or the state may encourage a regulator to allow relatively higher tariffs for SOEs for services. It might allow cross-subsidization within a state or enterprise. So one part of an SOE pursues a non-commercial mandate, which you can't actually fund from that component, and instead it's funded from a more profitable component. And then a final approach in more extreme situations is a cash transfer, sometimes referred to in a negative way as a bailout, in response to financial difficulty. So the rationale here being that if an SOE keeps pursuing non-commercial mandates that it can't actually afford, that will build up over time, negatively affect the financial status of an SOE, and the state will eventually come in and give them a cash transfer on the basis that their poor financial status is as a result of these non-commercial mandates that were previously unfunded. So those are implicit funding mechanisms because they're not specifically related to a particular non-commercial mandate. Now, economists are generally not in favor of this approach, but nevertheless, it can be an acceptable second-best solution in certain situations, particularly not, as we know here, when the cost of the mandate is large. So if we're talking about relatively inexpensive non-commercial mandates, then some cost subsidization within the SOE might actually be all right. It's not ideal, but when it comes to the cost of formalizing that mandate, it might even be preferable. The downside is that when non-commercial mandates are large, performance monitoring is very difficult for the reasons I just explained. Under some circumstances, particularly in the context of what are referred to as bailouts, financing costs might increase. So it might actually be cheaper to fund a non-commercial mandate up front rather than wait to get to a situation where an SOE is in financial trouble and the cost of supporting them, both the government and the SOE, is quite high. And it's unlikely, implicit financing is unlikely to work well when mandate costs are very large. Okay, so what's the alternative? The alternative is to separate mandates, and that's what the minister was referring to. The Presidential Review Committee report very much endorses this approach. It argues that non-commercial mandates should be explicitly contracted and funded by the state, and that's consistent with the current trend in the international literature and the National Development Plan. Some reasons for explicit separation of funding arise from the previous discussion. You want to make sure that state-owned enterprise is adequately compensated. And adequately compensated compensated means not giving them too much money for their developmental mandate, but also making sure that you give them enough. They should be disadvantaged relative to a commercial enterprise because they're pursuing a non-commercial mandate. So it may well be that the government establishing an SOE or retaining an SOE to pursue that mandate. Another important advantage is that it makes the cost of mandate transparent. So that transparency enables oversight. It's generally beneficial, with the democratic today. But it also enables better prioritization of mandates. So if enterprise is pursuing 5 different non-commercial mandates, if those costs are not made explicit, then it might be that actually the most costly of those mandates is the least important one to take. But without costing the mandates, you're unable to prioritize. So costing them and prioritizing them strengthens performance monitoring and evaluation, which is the concern of both these committees and other committees and parties. In practice, of course, this is not straightforward. There are very different approaches, and all share similar requirements and challenges. What some countries at the extreme end of the spectrum, what some countries opt to do is to commercialize non-commercial mandates. What this means is that the state sets up essentially a procurement process. So if you take the National Electrification Program, what the responsible government department would do would be to design a tender for the rollout of electrification. And then Exxon would be asked to bid for that tender. So in other words, you set up a situation which is more like a private market, but you have SOEs competing for those tenders. That has some merits, but it also comes with a number of risks, an obvious one of which is that it introduces a lot of uncertainty into SOE planning and financing, and like all tender and procurement processes, it relies on adequate competition. And if you bear in mind that a lot of major SOEs are in a monopolistic or oligopolistic position in the economy, that might not be feasible. But just to give you a sense of what the one end of the spectrum looks like. So among the challenges in separating mandates are defining them operationally, costing them, and determining appropriate financing mechanisms. In the South African context, probably the best place to deal with such an issue would be in the shareholder compact between state-owned enterprises and the state shareholder. So just put together a bit of a diagram to give an indication of a rough indication of what this process might look like. Any non-commercial mandate really starts out with a fiscal decision about the role of the state-owned enterprise and socially beneficial activities they should be pursuing. But given that political decision, let's say electrification, that's going to be defined operationally. So what does it mean operationally to make sure that every country has access to electricity infrastructure? From that, you can then estimate the cost. And then having estimated the cost, the question is that feasible? If the state decides it's not feasible to allocate a particular amount of money to a non-commercial mandate, then maybe you have to start again and say, okay, how can we reconsider the intention, the political intention, the policy intention, given the financial constraints of the state? If it is decided that it's financially feasible, I'm referring to what your financial word for reconsidered. I'm sure there's a specific term, reevaluate. The issue at this point is not so about the funding model. The issue is about whether it's feasible. So at this point, you would cost the non-commercial mandate, say $5 billion. The relevant department would cost it. It would presumably have a discussion with National Treasury about funds available. And National Treasury might say, that's not feasible in the current time, given the allocation the department's going to get in the next year. This is on the assumption that it will be explicitly funded. So typically the process would be that National Treasury would ensure that the allocations to the relevant shareholders and departments would be adequate, and that the public would transfer the money to relevant state-owned enterprise. And at that point, then one would consider the issue raised by Honourable Tobias, which is what is an appropriate financing mechanism. So the typical direct approach would be for a shareholder's department to channel the funds to the state-owned enterprise. But there are other alternatives, which we'll discuss in the next section, which will cause alternative financing mechanisms for SOEs. So the ideal under this separation model is to go through this process and end up with an explicitly identified, detailed, and funded non-commercial mandate. What it then allows the government, the state to do, and Parliament to conduct oversight over is prioritize these non-commercial mandates based on their social benefits and based on their cost, enterprise and government. In the report, what we tried to do was, at the end of each section, end of these four sections, to have a list of key issues that were of particular relevance to members, could be the basis for follow-up work, and discussions with relevant government departments. So as related to non-commercial mandates, these are some of the important questions for members might be interested in. The first is, to what extent non-commercial mandates contribute to current equity financing requirements? So for any given state of enterprise, or the appearing before committees in Parliament, in relation to its financial status, what role does non-commercial mandate play in their outcomes? Are existing state-owned enterprise financing initiatives taking into account the consequences of past non-commercial mandates and current and future mandates? Are there cases where implicit financing mandates undermine the state's broader development objectives? Just to give an example that we discussed in the report, and again, with the caveat that we're not necessarily endorsing this claim, but one claim that has been made, for example, is the transit port tariffs is too high. This has been an ongoing issue. I worked in the Department of Transport over a decade ago. It's still being discussed there. So that's a claim that's been made. The port tariffs are very important to the transit revenue. Some parties argue that they're too high, and that's impeding industrial development. So an important question is whether that is the case. So these port tariffs might be implicitly funding non-commercial mandates within transit, in which case, to some extent, that's a different financing approach, but it might be impeding other developmental objectives. And again, that's another good reason for making non-commercial mandates explicit. Another important question is, do the existing guidelines for shareholder compact make adequate provision for mandate separation and funding? So National Treasury is talking about developing this framework. It seems fairly clear that the appropriate place to place a lot of those details would be in shareholder compact. But are there structures in such a way, are those discussions, do they operate in such a way to make this feasible? That brings to an issue which I think we've mentioned in the past to both committees, which is about the question of progress in providing shareholder compact to parliamentary committees. This has been an ongoing question. We went back to members of the Public Enterprise in the past, and the NDP is quite explicit that shareholder compact should be made public and bank statements should be available to Parliament. So that's in order to enable oversight, but particularly important for one instance of commercial mandate. Another question which really arises, I think, from the Presidential Review Committee report is what role might the draft Government Shareholder Management Bill, or ECHO's Act, play in addressing the separation and financing of non-commercial mandates? And finally, what are the alternatives to separation in cases where it's not feasible? Because separation is actually a complex process, and if there are cases where it's not possible, what are the alternatives? Having said which, it seems to be a case with quite a lot of scope to go down the road of at least identifying, clearly stating, and financing non-commercial mandates before one gets to the point of actually saying that that's not feasible. So that's the conclusion of that section. So just proceed through and then...
I think this type of presentation gives us a lot of information which maybe honourable members will immediately interact with it before we go to the other one. I suggest to you we can raise questions and comment on this one and then we proceed to the next presentation. And we must also be mindful of our time. Thank you. Honourable members, I think we can start with the intention. Honourable Soya, and then Honourable Yenye.
Thank you, Chair. Actually, I would love to share the whole day just for discussion because what Sean has presented here would have required a date to be delivered. The presentation is to whether do you need a developmental stage or do you need a regulatory stage in terms of intervention for trade. And that means that takes the whole day. In terms of the morning that she used to carry here. Now I'll go to, before I go to the questions and the plans that I want to do, I want to set that as a comment that might put me in trouble. You see, Sean, when you speak about Transnet, if it was my own, and I'm saying it might put me in trouble, I would have preferred that if a vessel that is belonging to Petro SA is working, it will get a priority to us and it will have a different perhaps all it's because the role of Petro SA is different from Chevron or any other company that is selling oil to us. So I would have wished it happened that way. So I would have wished that that vessel would not be charged a commercial price, but a different price also. I'm not raising it, actually, I was just raising my mission here.
Money.
the developmental one, and it will always remain like that. It will never be represented as what must be achieved by that. You spoke about this kind of thing. I would love to put your opinion on it. You try to stay as far away from me to your own food in terms of what you need to do, but to get money, if you want to get money. At some point, I'll want you to present to us the operational expenditure, investment, and the CC expenditure that it is getting involved, so that we can how the those models have been and use for it, how we can work for us, looking at the approach that our needs are going to be moving for. I think we're going to share that.
Thank you, Chairman. Let's try to make comments first and in appreciation of this endeavor, putting this committee together and debate this important aspect. It is not hypothetical to view that says there is a desirability and feasibility to achieve a developmental stage as a country through the utilization of the state-owned digital policies. That one is a foregone conclusion. Yes, we aspire to be a true developmental state. As the Honourable Tobias has reflected through the importance of further engaging on this matter, I fully concur with that, because there is a number of questions that need to be answered in order to be on the same level of understanding between us at the parliamentary level and the executive, including the state-owned enterprises, in as far as understanding their role, the state-owned enterprises, in achieving a developmental stage. Commercial driven as they are, but what is needed is to ensure that we rise as a country and reach the level of the development state. And one of the attributes, share of the development state, is the ability of the communities to be involved and participate in their own development. Now, when you look and listen to the presentations of the by all the stage of enterprises, there is no indication or bias in relation to the involvement of the public in the activities of the SOEs. It's only a social responsibility. Today we built a school and adopted a particular home. That is a social responsibility that can be done by an individual. But on a broader basis, we need to imagine what you have said and what has been said. This, you know, this analysis that has been brought here by the presenter, he is an eye-opener in order for us to locate the role of the state-owned enterprises, because prophecies of doom would say we don't need these state-owned enterprises, we lack the capacity to maintain or sustain them. That is more political. But really, what we need to do is to ensure that they are not just commercial as commercial bodies belonging to an individual. They are commercial bodies, but owned by the state. State is a public entity.
What are you
saying?
The issue of the shareholder compact, an issue that we've always been talking about at the level of our portfolio committee, to say it's important that the compact needs to be made available to us for us to do our oversight, but we don't seem to be winning in the practice. I want to share from you team that I have met, Rapid. So, I don't question if you think we are going to have consequences for either of you that are not extremely expected in terms of the story of the country.
Honorable Mazzoni will be followed by Honorable Rosat at the end and then
Mr. Chairperson. Chairperson, I don't think we should get into an ideological discussion here because that's not what this is about. It's about how we fund state-owned entity, which as we know at the moment are draining our fiscus and are putting great strain on our fiscus. Chair, a couple of issues. The state-owned entity has targets that they set for themselves. And they have targets that they set for the executive. Now, in our portfolio, public enterprise, you will know this is one of the things that concerns us greatly because bonuses and incentives are paid out to top executives because they achieve these targets. And then we go back and we look at these targets, and anyone could achieve these targets because these targets are unrealistic. Now, certainly, as Treasury and Finance Committee, we need to look at putting a lot more pressure on our state-owned entities to ensure that the targets that we set for executives are realistic and our targets that a normal private company would set for their executives and that we're not creating soft targets which are easy to achieve. Then I think another very important issue we need to look at in our state-owned entities is the lack of capacity that we have in our executives to deal with labour relations issues. Now, yesterday you were seeing that ESCOM released an update basis on bills, and the Duke and Cecilia are both now being extended by a period of 2 years, and one of the primary reasons for this extension was labour actions taking place at both sites. Now, you see, these seem like small things, but at the end of the day, if our state-owned entities and those in charge of their finances don't start getting these things right, and we don't start putting people in positions of state-owned entities that actually know what they're doing in terms of drafting their budgets, in terms of putting austerity measures in place, in terms of labour relations, we could be caught in a vicious cycle. And it's frustrating not only to the members of Parliament, but to South Africans because they hear the continual waste. And in that regard, I must highlight the fact that the Finance Committee that we recently had an interaction with Echo Express. And for the first time in a long time, it was a very pleasant interaction. Because along came a board who realised that their company was in dire straits, implemented very stringent austerity measures, made sure that these austerity measures were being adhered to, even though very unpopular decisions were being taken, such as stagnating any pay increases and making sure that no bonuses or incentives were paid out, making sure that staff were, the components of staff were being looked at in a fair fashion towards the staff so that we wouldn't have labour strikes, etc. In other words, people were put into positions at SAXX who knew how to turn a failing company around. And that actually started bringing. In actual fact, we saw SAXX first going to profit for the first time in a long time. Now, to sum everything I've said up, how do we, as public enterprise and finance, come together and say it goes this far but it actually can go no further? Because there actually comes a point where there just is no more money to continuously throw at a company that refuses to turn itself out of dire straits into a break-even or even into a profit area. That's what we need to be looking at. And perhaps we need to get SA Express to come in and explain exactly step by step to all the other state-owned entities how they implemented their austerity turnaround measures, because whatever they did, actually worked.
No, thank you very much, Chair. You know, the previous speaker touched on some of the issues that we should be looking at, and I'm glad that we are not conducting the ideological approach here, because as Honorable Tani put it, the ideological platform that we are standing on, unfortunately, we can't deviate from it because we have a historical context that you can't just say, you know, things are going to work as usual. But what I think we ought to be looking at are operational efficiencies, because there is nothing wrong necessarily with the ideological approach from what I can see. But it seems to be a problem with issues around governance, around management, around leadership, around the will to do the right thing, around productivity, around those types of issues. And these are some of the issues that are actually sabotaging that very developmental agenda that we have. And these governance issues are actually very central to what we are talking about here. And the reason why, Chair, I think it's going to be absolutely important, Sean has put some key issues that we need to look at here. However, the challenge that I have is that we seem to be moving from untested assumptions. Now, why I say untested assumptions? It's because we are now, there's a recommendation that we now need to look as to what extent has non-commercial mandates contributed to current SOP financing requirements. To me, I think that is a step down the road, that one. It's not the final step that we should be looking at. But what we need to be looking at, to me, I think we need to be going back to the basics and looking at how have these, the cost of capital of these entities. We need to understand what is the cost of capital of these entities. We need to understand how has their liquidity ratio change over time, so that we understand and what were the factors and what were the environment at that time. In other words, we need a systematic approach in this issue to look at cause and effect, so that we can deal with it. At the moment, I think we are just dealing with the symptom and we are kind of panicking and saying, we have a problem, hey, what can we do? And we will end up getting into the very problem that we will end up not correcting the problem, but we will be exacerbating. And I think, although I understand that you said this is just a desktop kind of analysis that you've done, you have not necessarily interrogated the primary sources, some of those sources might actually be very important to me, because this is not just an easy matter. It's very easy for people to think that this issue has got to do with ideology. I certainly don't agree with that. I don't think that there is anything wrong with the state, you know, being a major shareholder in these entities. But I think the issue that we need is to look seriously, because in every single private sector, there's a net problem, governance issues are central. And I don't think we should be shying away from that. It's about time we begin to look at that. And I mean, we have China, which is a very good example of how operational efficiency can improve productivity. It's got nothing to do with the ideology. They are producing and to a point where they are other customers. So that means that it's not an ideological matter that we are dealing with here. We need to establish the code of capital. And the reason why I'm saying this is because right now, as we speak, we do have a big challenge the government, if you look at Eskom as a good example, their cost of borrowing is going to skyrocket, because they have now been reduced to a junk status. And that has implications with their leveraging on the private capital or external capital that we often go to when we are looking at such major infrastructure investment. So I am saying we need to look at that. And I also think that we also do need to be given, maybe we need to go also, maybe you can share with us on whether you have actually looked at the historical financing structure of these institutions, you know. And part of the reason why that is also important is because it's going to assist us to see where are the leakages and be able to deal with those leakages. And it means there is something that says there must be something that we have not done right over the past few years. We've done a lot of good things right, but there's a lot of bad things that have happened as well in the past few years, which has resulted is to understand when companies declare dividends, when these properties are declared dividends, obviously there are also private shareholders there. What happens to our precaution as government? I'm now beginning to look at what you are proposing. This thing of saying maybe we need to take the non-commercial and we must fund those. And I'm actually looking at, you know, the possibility of actually utilizing the very dividends that are there. Why should it stay taking the taxpayers' money and putting in those non-commercial mandates? I'm saying maybe we need an in-depth study. Probably at this stage, I'm not sure that Sean is going to be assisting me here to tell me what has been the trend, how has it been done before, and what is currently happening. Because when we hear, I mean, 3 years ago, we are hearing all these companies, declaring dividends, and we've become very profitable, blah, 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 it was all nice and sweet. You know, so we need to know what happened to those resources, where they distributed, what happened to them, where they reinvested in infrastructure, where is that infrastructure that they spent it on? And those type of issues are going to be quite important for us to be able to arrive at a sensible and well thought through decision. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Let me start by welcoming this part of the presentation. Look, I do have some few recommendations, but I think at the end of the presentation, we will have quite an opportunity to discuss. Because I think the presentation made, of course, it covers, or maybe the nature of this particular report covers quite a very, very substantial thing. But for now, I'm not going to take you, I just want to pose one particular question. But before that, I think, Chairperson, it's important that we reiterate the concern raised by Honorable Tobias, the issue of the incidents encountered by the parliamentary budget office accept some of the information. Mm-hmm. And I firmly support that we don't have, assets that we don't have, the numerical analysis presented to this joint committee. Because numerical analysis will give us detailed information as to where are the key problems and where are the gaps. But in spite, I think that we recommend, I'll take it on our to recommend, we will talk to that. And my second question, of course, I fully agree, we are not doing this for the first time. As for the picture chart in the presentation, it was cited in 2014 MTPS that there is a need to separate the EO Commission non-commercial the cost of the now, I just wanted to check, I don't know if this was also affected by this lack of information for the video. Is there any preliminary or any report that indicates on the impact of this non-commercial activity or non-commercial mandate on the finding status of stable enterprise that you were able to lay your hands on? That will also be very, very helpful because I just want to say that informs the conclusion. Because then, if there is proper report on the impact of such on the financial status of its own enterprises, then it will be easy for one to follow as to why this conclusion. I mean, that's my reason, basically, question. But furthermore, I think the issues of the correlations will be very, very.
Thank you very much. Okay. No, they are mostly well behaved. I'll stick to the question. Well, my question tends around the issue around the commercial money, the non-commercial money. I know towards the end of your presentation, you highlighted the fact that the non-commercial money sometimes very dichotomic. And yet there are very important in the context of our assessment of the developmental objectives. The question one to ask is that, say for example, we would at some point then have to propose for, as you're saying, the finding of non-conventional countries, but the question is that I don't find the case where the South Africa because of that. Because it's very difficult to quantify. But when you also look at the issue around the price takers, yes, it's difficult. We should resist the ecological temptation to actually study the ecological temptation. But there may have been a rationale in some sectors of the economy for parasitas maybe to pay all the state wanted prices to pay all. Has the time not come in some sectors for state wanted both enterprises to start retreating and allowing the private sector maybe to play a role, which would also in my view maybe improve their efficiency and they might be more focused? That's the question I want to know. Thank you very much.
Let's allow Sean and the team to respond to the question.
I'll respond and then refer to Mr. Chipping whenever you feel appropriate. Honourable Tobias has a number of questions. I know, Honourable Tobias, you said that you were just raising an issue today, but I think the example of transfer, which I said, is perfectly appropriate to raise because it again comes to the question of the developmental state, and what you're raising really is the question of whether collaboration between state and enterprise should define anything about the consistent. And I think that has been a question, I think, in policy. Right now, it often works on purely commercial sort of arms length basis. And that's really a policy question to be dealt with. The issue of backlogs in service delivery and developmental state, I think that's certainly, I think maybe the term is for maybe cost-benefit analysis is what you have in mind for considering the desirability of particular non-commercial mandates. As you rightly indicate, some of these non-commercial mandates arise from the state's constitutional obligations. And in that sense, are not really a matter of pursuing or not pursuing. But nevertheless, there has to be a staged process in the context of the resources available. But I think that the key point is that an SOE is expected to be financially viable, can't be required to fulfill a constitutional mandate if it's not adequate to fund. I think that's really the point. It's not to say that that all commercial, non-commercial mandates are up for grabs, but if an SOE is expected to implement one, it should have adequate financing, and the state is ultimately responsible for that. On the question of different models, I think the one thing I should have said at the beginning of the presentation is we always try to do that period of recommendations, as is also a good practice of parliamentary bypassing internationally. So we are intentions to put models on the table and not actually involve any particular one. Because there is lots of different merits, and so we remember to make those recommendations. The issue of the net effect of the developmental mandate, I think it's quite true that from a sort of ideal government point of view, the government should be thinking about is the net benefit to society worthwhile? Is it positive? But of course, from the SOE's perspective, ultimately they have to ensure that they're ongoing concern. They're going to concern their financially viable. So in their context, it does boil down to some extent to the financial state, for the shareholders, and to the broader social interest. So the issue of cash transfers in the different models, as I said, we sort of put those on the table. And I think I'll mention some of the related other questions that were asked, but the appropriate models also like to vary depending on the SOE. So on one hand, and the BRC particularly pushes this view, there should be consistency across the enterprise, particularly in terms of, say, corporate governance. But at the same time, it's also important that the particular industry and context of SOE is considered adopting different financial models, and it won't necessarily be the same. In terms of the breakdown of SOE expenditures, certainly, as been indicated in the report and previous presentations, and also in presentations and appropriations, the PBO can do further work on particular enterprises. And that's what we'll be asked to provide useful information, because just coming with expenditure on particular things is not useful, unless we have very clear about why expenditures are at a particular level. That would be part of the proposal question that I'll get back to. I hope that addresses most of your concerns. Honourable Lu Yenge made a point about the role of again, that would sort of approximate something as a recommendation. I don't think there's any objective way of necessarily saying that punishment or reward is enough in general. But the other issue is that it's quite hard to say in the absence of seeing the shareholder compact. But also, and I'll mention this in reference to some of the other questions as well, is that in a policy environment where things like non-commercial mandates are not, at least not to members of the parliament, not necessarily always owned and not necessarily always costed, if it's not possible to tell why targets weren't met, and where the targets are appropriate or inappropriate because they're vulnerable, then it's hard to determine whether the punishment or reward is appropriate. Because it's not clear whether those targets are reasonable in the first place, you don't know necessarily what they are, and why they weren't reached. So, unfortunately, I can't give a simple answer to your question. But I think that's very much in terms of other factors, obviously, the point you want to be able to get to is to say, what should the enterprise be doing? And if they don't do it, how are you going to be held accountable? I think, to the extent that there's ever sort of lack of clarity on what they should be doing and whether their plans are adequate, it'll be hard to do that. I think that's very much to come to the literature on non-commercial mandate. If you're not clear, it's very hard to hold things to account. To Honourable McDonough's questions about targets. As I say, you know, the report we did didn't really touch on questions of governance. Members know that governance is very important. Naturally, it will have an effect on operations. It will have an effect on finances. It wasn't within the scope of our report. Unfortunately. So one thing, just because it was asked as a question, an issue of setting targets, I think it can't be also to my engagement with colleagues at TME, performance monitoring, planning monitoring and evaluation standards. This is a problem in all evaluation monitoring systems, but where you have, economists think of this in terms of the sort of like principal agent problem. In state-owned enterprises, you have a shareholder, that's the principal, and you have the agents of the state-owned enterprise, and the principal wants the SOE to do a particular thing, but the SOE has its own incentives and so on. When you ask an enterprise to set its own targets, an enterprise would be ill-advised to set itself targets that are overly ambitious. And in some cases, it might be desirable for an enterprise to set targets that are easy to achieve. This is not unique to SOEs. It happens in employment, performance monitoring as well. It happens in lots of something. But that is a general problem, I think. It doesn't arise just in industry. It arises everywhere. But again, it comes to the question of, do we have a clear enough understanding of what these SOEs are required to achieve? Are the targets reasonable, and are they also difficult enough to meet that they require good levels of performance? I know that the point about SOE questions and comments, but I think just to get back to the point that was made to Honourable Daly's questions, there's not going to be any single model, certainly based on the initial examination done at different SOEs, their performance and so on. The fact that contributing to their financial situation is also very different, and the extent to which they are dealing with different types of non-commercial mandates. But anyway, that's more on the governance front. To Honourable Cook's point about also about governance issues, I won't touch on that any further. The question about untested assumptions and unfunded mandates, I think that's a very important question. Of course, the reason we did work on this is because the issue was raised by the National Treasury and the Minister in terms of setting out a new framework in the context of concern about SOE financing. Our intention actually with this analysis was actually to do what's different, which is to go back to basics. Because if we look at, for example, National Treasury, I think the Public Enterprises Committee last year presented, you know, we tried to do what the committee was interacting with, presented a diagram in which different SOEs were classified based on their financial status. So they were either in a sort of red zone, or an orange zone, or in a green zone. And my colleague, Dr. Janji, produced a similar type of analysis based on particular financial issues. One of the reasons we decided not to use that in the report is because our concern was that it's potentially a little simplistic in the context of the types of issues that these committees want to deal with. Because you might have an enterprise that's in the green zone, but then the green zone, because they've been given maybe overly generous tariff allocation, and they're not performing much in the way of non-development, in non-commercial mandates, where you might have another SOE that's in the red zone, because its tariff award is being inadequate, it hasn't received adequate capitalization from the state, and it's got large non-commercial mandates. So certainly we would agree, I think with a detailed analysis of a particular SOE, we would definitely look at cost of capital and other aspects of expenditure, equity ratios, and so on. But in order to actually interpret the meaning of those, we would need which is the historical approach to financing that particular entity, what's been the history in terms of infrastructure investment, financing by the state, and so on. So, and non-commercial mandates play a big role in that. But as I said, it's not issues that that we raise. So essentially, we're developing an analysis based on the issues raised by the minister. As you'll see, I mean, to what extent is non-commercial mandates contributed to current SOE financing requirements? It's an open question because, as Honourable Fanon was asking whether a report is being produced on this question, to our knowledge, there hasn't been. So there's a lot of speculation. And in some sense, what this analysis is suggesting is a good reason to make these mandates clear and the cost of them clear to avoid that speculation. Maybe the speculation is incorrect. Maybe the non-commercial mandates haven't had a big impact on SOE finance. But certainly there have been managers within these SOEs, analysts who have a prime knowledge of them, and also members of various departments and so on, that suggested that these mandates have contributed to the situation. And at the moment, few of us are actually in a position to definitively answer that question, and that hinders oversight. Because if you can't answer that question, then you don't know whether their financial performance is due to their own poor performance as management, or whether it's actually because they're being asked to do things that they're not being paid for. So, I think that's really the point there. In relation to dividends, I think maybe that your question will be covered well in the next section, but there are sometimes reasons why you might want to. It seems strange for the government to take dividends from an SOE and then give it back to them, say, for a non-commercial mandate. And that's really the rationale for a business financing. As well, let's just leave it. We won't expect the dividends and won't pay them for the non-commercial mandate, and we'll assume it'll just kind of balance out. But the downside of that is sometimes it comes with cost of accountability. So it might be preferable to make sure that the enterprise is performing as you'd like it to explicitly pay them for the non-commercial mandate, and then make sure that they earn a dividend on the capital status put in, that is at the level of 2. So even though the total amount might be the same, but still, because of the incentive structure you created there, so it might be desirable to do that. So I mean, it's exactly that kind of question that needs to inform the different financing models that are adopted particular SOE. So Honourable Fanon was then asking about the report. Unfortunately, there isn't one. There isn't a report on the effects of loss of, of non-commercial mandates on SOEs, their financial status in particular. I will talk a little bit more about data access. I think we have found that a little frustrating, but I think it's also partly a reflection of the fact that the parliamentary budget is a new institution. And so in some cases, it's a government entity has got its public information, which we could compile ourselves from, for example, the estimates of national expenditure, but it would take us maybe weeks to do it, and it's inefficient when national treasury has it all together in an Excel spreadsheet. Then in other cases, of course, there might be sensitive information, and that's partly maybe an issue of establishing adequate protocols between parliamentary committees, relevant state entity, and the parliamentary budget office, so the issues of process there. Honourable Nkwamba, after the very interesting question about SOEs and state their financing requirements. So that's definitely a risk, I think, in the costing process. It comes back to this question of the principal agent problem. So an SOE, one really wouldn't expect an SOE to underestimate the cost of a non-commercial mandate if it's going to be funded by the state, because they will pay, they'll deal with consequences of that later on. And typically, given the incentives that are faced by executives in any organization, whether it's a SOE or a private company, one would expect the cost to be more likely to be inflated than underestimated. And so then that's also the process. So if there is going to be an explicit costing of these mandates, how is that going to happen in a credible way? But to some extent, that kind of process already exists when it comes, for example, to an independent regulator determining whether tariff increases are adequate or not. As I'll talk about in the next component, that has been problematic. So the challenge, but it needn't necessarily be an insurmountable one, but you need to set up the financing system in such a way that the state is not relying on an SOE saying, well, we need 5 billion land to expand access to by this much in 2015-16. And just to use that example, at the moment, Eskom does receive this financing for electrification and for provision of free basic electricity. So there is a process there. If that deemed to be successful, it could be replicated elsewhere if appropriate. So I think Chef has answered all the questions. Shall I move on to the next question?
Yeah, before you move on, Sean, I just wanted to find out whether we are using the right terminology in relation to non-commercial mandates.
But I also said, well, it's very diagram
it. But now one also has different forms of state financing. So a government can finance an SOE in a variety of ways. Most obviously it can provide a cash injection. So it transfers cash straight from the National Revenue Fund to an SOE, and that would be in the form of an appropriation bill of the kind that we saw recently for ESCOM. It can also provide loans, say on enterprises, and government guarantees, which support the SOE's own borrowing. So the government will guarantee a debt to state owned enterprise, and the SOE will then go and borrow private capital markets. Another mechanism for financing, which strictly speaking is not within the direct control of government, is through an economic regulator. So in fact, typically, like any other commercial enterprise, a lot of the revenue for an SOE comes from sales of whatever its product is. In the case of ESCOM, that would be electricity. In the case of Transnet, it would be port services or freight rail services. And the money it gets from those will typically be determined in the models being adopted in the southern context by an economic regulator. So to the extent the government is able to affect the decisions made by an economic regulator, that will determine the extent of financing available to an SOE through that channel. So all of these are different approaches, and one thing that's also important to note in the context of Parliament is that oversight of these different mechanisms is sometimes spread across different committees. So I'm just going to use ESCOM as an example. It's a topical, and the Parliamentary Budget Office has been dealing with various aspects of ESCOM financing, but typically separated out. So for example, there was the ESCOM Special Appropriation Bill, which was essentially a cash injection, and that went to the Standing and Select Committee on Appropriation. There was the conversion of a loan, that bill also went to the Appropriations Committee, but originally the loan agreement was brought before the predecessor Standing Committee on Finance, so before the Money for Bank Portfolio Committee on Finance. Government guarantees do not have to be approved by any parliamentary committee, but the Standing Committee on Finance has oversight over the fiscal framework and the and some sense the macroeconomy as well, so it has responsibility for keeping an eye on the overall level of government guarantees and the risk associated with those. When it comes to regulators and holding them accountable, Parliament typically hasn't played as direct a role in that, but for example, NERSA might more often be expected to account to the Portfolio Committee on Energy. So what's important about this is that the different financing mechanisms are the responsibility of different components of the executive and therefore different components of Parliament. But they all affect the financial status of the state enterprise. So again, as raised earlier, if an SOE finds itself in a poor financial situation, and given the fact that the CRP is responsible for ensuring that state enterprises have adequate financing, which aspect of this diagram is responsible? So that's the critical issue for oversight. So again, in some cases, is it inefficiency of the SOE when it comes to operational or investment expenditure? Is it non-commercial mandates that are unfunded and excessive relative to the finance available? Or is it that, for example, there have been inadequate tariffs awarded to a state-owned enterprise? Similarly, if you find a state-owned enterprise that's in a very good financial situation, is it necessarily because the SOE is performing very well, or has it received excessive cash injections from governments and overly generous tariff allocations? So it's actually a very complicated system. It's more complicated than for a private investor to hold a company in which they're a shareholder accountable. And so when it comes to asking the question of are SOEs being held adequately accountable, are the rewards or punishments sufficient, it's important to also ask the question, is the assessment of performance accurate given all these different factors? So it sounds like a very simple thing to say, but the critical point really is that the balance matters when it comes to SOE financing. Financial outcomes can be compromised by a number of sources. Of course, why they should finance an SOE depends on the role that enterprise is expected to play and its historical funding and capitalization. As I noted before, government can provide direct or indirect financial support. And these have different merits, and that's really what I'm going to talk about, I think, for the remainder of the session. Just one note, because the PRC makes quite a strong recommendation in relation to what it calls non-financially viable commercial SOEs. And the problem really is that in the context of a fairly identify a non-financially viable commercial SOE. And a simple approach would be to go and look at SOE balance sheets right now and see which ones are performing badly and conclude that those are not financially viable. But that's not necessarily accurate because those SOEs might have been undercapitalized in the past. They might have large non-commercial mandates. I think you probably get where I'm going with this because, again, having these roles and finance resources to clarify is really important for determining rationalization as well as future SOE policy. So if you can rationalize SOEs based on their financial performance, it must be clear why they're performing the way that they are. Okay, so actually, I give a list there of the different recommendations that the CRC has made. I'm not going to go into those at the time that they're there for industry. Anyway, those are key recommendations and policy proposals. PBO doesn't have a position on those either way, but obviously the appropriateness of them will depend on the SOE question. Okay, so as I was saying, these sort of academic or conceptual issues, I mean, it is always a concern when we do our analysis that we get sort of too high level. But I think in producing this report, we actually get the conclusion that these are very important concepts in order to be able to understand what's going on with financing of SOE. So we kept them in actually the analysis in the report is quite detailed. It's important that members are talking about international comparisons. It's important for members to know that the move in the international literature in terms of SOE financing is towards the notion of what's referred to as competitive neutrality. This is particularly the case with the OECD. And the idea basically is that the state supports the state owned enterprises should not benefit those enterprises relative to potential or actual private sector competitors. The idea is basically that if that happens, these entities will not perform efficiently. So this is very much an approach premised around the notion that efficiency comes through market discipline. And if the state provides beneficial funding to SOEs, that allows them to operate less efficiently than equivalent private sector actors. There have been, there wasn't really an explicit statement about competitive neutrality in most of the policy documents we looked at, although it is endorsed by the Presidential Review Committee in the context of economic regulation. But in draft, we have incrementally adopted some of these things. So for example, the National Treasury's policy allows for it to charge SOEs debt guarantee fees and to charge market-related interest rate on loans. Two issues arise there. The one actually is that National Treasury hasn't fully implemented that policy. That's particularly clear in the case of ESCOM, where although market-related loan fees were charged, they were conditional on ESCOM's financial performance. So ESCOM didn't actually end up paying interest on the loan that got converted, and as a result, actually, of about 60 billion rand loan, almost half of that was immediately recognized as equity on ESCOM's balance sheet. That's a matter of historical detail, I suppose. The other issue is how competitive neutrality, which is sort of the approach that economic regulators take and to some extent what Treasury policy allows, how that's compatible with the developmental state orientation. Typically, economies that pursue this approach tend to very much leave SOEs to self-finance. Once they've been initially capitalized, they rarely get additional support from the state, and often the sectors in which they operate are sufficiently developed that they have private sector capacity. That's not the case for a lot of SOEs in South Africa, particularly the larger one, and so it's an open question really how applicable this is. It is a very important principle when considering SOE financing. The second issue is direct versus indirect funding, which we spoke about already. Bear in mind that this report came about in the context of declining economic growth, declining government revenue collection, but declining the growth of government revenue collection. So the state finances are being seized. There's less growth to finance SOEs. Now, in that context, distinguish between explicit and explicit financing, okay, non-commercialized assets, that's one issue, and then direct and indirect funding. They're related, but let's keep them distinct. So direct funding of state owned enterprise, one of the examples where the state transfers money, so 23 billion rand to that's direct funding. The downside of that, of course, is it places pressure on business. And in the context of very little what's referred to by National Treasury fiscal space, that becomes problematic. So an alternative is to use So the report focuses on three particular types of indirect funding. The first is economic regulation or parent determination. The second one is debt guarantees, which create contingent liabilities. And then the third is public-private partnerships and debt arrangements. So that's basically the involvement of private capital. So just for the sake of time, I'm going to get straight into it. The first one, economic regulation, as I said, is particularly important for determining the revenues that state owned enterprises obtain from the market. And current regulation is particularly the responsibility in most sectors of independent economic regulators. The Presidential Review Committee notes a couple of serious concerns with regulation today. The first is that in some cases, tariff awards have been lower than desirable, and this had a very negative effect on SOE finance, particularly in the case where SOEs are pursuing large infrastructure programs. The second issue is that in some cases there may have been potentially excessive tariff awards that might have compromised efficient operation of SOEs and the state's industrial policy objectives. The thing is, the tariffs are a very appealing way of reducing the strain on the fiscal. So in the current environment where the state doesn't have much money to spare to prop up state-owned enterprises that are struggling financially for whatever reason, it's appealing to believe that the problem can be resolved by having higher tariffs for those state-owned enterprises. The downside, that's useful in terms of stabilizing government's finances. The problem with tariffs is that they do have their own downsides, and those are not necessarily subject to direct parliamentary oversight. So they have distributional consequences. In some instances, the poor end up paying more of the tariff increase than the rich, who might be able to opt into alternative providers. They can have serious effects on economic activity, particularly because of their impact on service. And there's another issue, which is that, and the National Treasury produced some reports on this about a decade ago, that these forms of administered prices, so administered prices managed by the state or economic regulators, can contribute to inflation. So government might shift the burden from government's balance sheet onto consumers and firms. That leads to inflation, say electricity is an obvious example, electricity prices increase, that leads to inflation in the economy, and then the Reserve Bank, in as part of its inflation targeting mandate, raises interest rates, which have direct effect on economic growth. So there's no free lunch in this sense. It's a shift of the financing responsibility from the state balance sheet to the broader economy. But nevertheless, this is obviously a key option when the state is short of space. Another approach to indirect financing is using debt guarantees. So the idea here, this is consistent with the suggestion or the view that SOEs should fund themselves from their own balance sheet. And one can distinguish between this and the provision of loans. So if the state provides a loan to an SOE, the SOE is not operating on the basis of their balance sheet, it's not borrowing from private capital markets. But the state can still provide a loan guarantee to a state-owned enterprise, which supports them in borrowing from private capital markets. Basically, what happens is that the state provides a guarantee that for any reason the SOE defaults on its debt, doesn't repay its debt or interest on its debt, then the government will step in and pay those funds. Now, the advantages of this are that the debt stays on the SOE balance sheet, not government, and it can potentially reduce SOE borrowing costs to better reflect risk. So this is the sort of the type of argument that economists might make, is that, well, the reason governments do this is because it actually has better information on financial status and the future of the state and than the market. Markets can be subject to the various biases. Investors might lose confidence in an enterprise. The government knows that it's financially sound. The government will then provide a guarantee to that enterprise to help it borrow from private capital markets. So this is the advantage. The disadvantages, and again, there's an increasing literature on this, mostly because of the financial crisis and how it affected developed countries, is that contingent liabilities increase the risk of future demand on public finances, and they can accumulate over time with relatively little oversight. They allow countries and governments to defer financial difficulties to future periods, and that can encourage inefficiencies within state different ones here. I'm not going to talk through them because I thought members might be interested in being reminded. During the PBO's presentation on the 2015 budget, we gave some of these numbers. I think just to focus on that final number, the total guarantees issued by National Treasury amount to 461 billion rand. That's 11.9% of GDP, and the majority of these are held by Eskom. The other important point to note is that Eskom actually holds 350 billion rand in guarantees, but it hasn't yet borrowed against all those. So another question is, what is the view on how Eskom is going to use these guarantees in the future? And that's the issue that particularly arises for the Standing Committee on Finance, but then again also arises for the Portfolio Committee on Public Enterprises in monitoring Eskom financial situation. So we advise in that report, and would again assess that monitoring the risks of the fiscal framework posed by these liabilities may be advisable. And then the final source of indirect financing that the report considers is the involvement of private capital, and this also relates to the question that some members asked earlier. There are two types that we consider. The one is the involvement of equity. That's where a private shareholder would buy a stake in a state-owned enterprise, and that's fairly straightforward. And obviously the merits of that depend on, first of all, why a given enterprise is state-owned in the first place. And second, what the implications are of involving a private investor in the ownership and governance of an SOE. So it could be beneficial or not, but those are the two main questions that arise, and those are really policy questions, they're not financing questions. I think it's perhaps more useful to say a little bit about public-private partnerships. Again, these are something that are recommended quite strongly in some of the international literature. And the reason is because they can alleviate, well, there are two reasons. One is that they can alleviate the immediate funding problem of the state, and the second is that potentially they can allow for the involvement of private sector expertise, with the hope being that as a result, SOEs are better managed, better run, and more efficient. These claims that are made, and how things turn out in practice very much depends on the country and the SOE involved. One thing that comes out quite clearly from the literature is that it's important to recognize that PPPs, public-private partnerships, typically don't reduce the total financing burden. So what happens is that for example, a private partner is brought in to build a piece of infrastructure, which the state then purchases back from them or pays them back for at future periods in time. What that does is it means that the government doesn't have to take that infrastructure now, which is very useful if the government doesn't have the money to do so, but it's economically or socially important. But it will have to pay for it in the future. So it doesn't necessarily reduce the amount of money that the government society will have to pay over, say, a 20-year period. It just changes when we have to pay it. PPPs are accompanied by significant risks. Quite complicated contracts have to be structured to make sure that while the private partner gets a fair reward for their involvement, but they also have full responsibility at risk. That's one of the examples for literature where contracts being poorly structured, performance has been low, but costs have been high. And it's important to note in this regard also that there are, there are the political risks. And this talks to the question of credible commitments, what it must call credible commitments. Government considers that a private sector provider is responsible for providing water through a particular region by building the infrastructure and maintaining it adequately. But if the private sector provider doesn't do that, members of the public may not hold the private provider accountable, they may hold the relevant local government or provincial or national government responsible. And in that case, may not be credible for the government to say that private provider will be held fully accountable for any performance failures. And that's the kind of thing that's very important to take into account when designing a new contract. The National Treasury has a PDP unit, but it's broadly recognized even with countries that have good capacity of designing these contracts is challenging. So again, there's no free lunch. This is one option for shifting the burden off the government balance sheet in the short term, but for oversight purposes, it's really important to pay attention to the risks and future. The context in which members will probably be most familiar with this approach is in the context of user pays model to finance, of infrastructure financing. And in that case, the burden is entirely shifted off the government balance sheet in principle. It's shifted onto users of the infrastructure when it comes online. EPO to be an example. And as members will be aware from that example and others, these become with other risks and financial implications. And then, chairpersons, we have at the end of the section, as before, just a list of key issues. I think if it's okay with you, what I'll do is I'll just go through key issues and then I'll stop. I'm not going to talk about disclosure today. So some of the key issues that arise from this consideration of different financing mechanisms and different mechanisms of indirect financing as college. First of all, where does the responsibility within government lie for ensuring an appropriate balance between financing mechanisms? So if a data enterprise is in a poor financial situation because of inadequate parent awards, you know, who's responsible? Or alternatively, if an SOE is in a poor financial situation and we don't entirely know why, who is responsible for making sure that that's remedied? To what extent can existing financial challenges be alleviated by changes in SOE management or operations? I haven't spoken much about that. It touched on the issues of governance. But obviously it's important when it comes to providing additional financing to their enterprises to make sure that the reason that SOEs are performing badly is not because it is just poor performance or poor governance. And I think members have made that point themselves quite clearly. Assessing financial viability, as suggested by the Presidential Review Committee, requires accounting for weaknesses in funding policy frameworks. That comes across in the PRC report very clearly when it comes to economic regulation. So the PRC found that economic regulators had failed to make appropriate tariff determinations, but there were two reasons for that. And one was because of limited capacity on the side of the economic regulators, but the other was also that there was a policy framework which wasn't clear enough in terms of the responsibility of SOEs and what were actually appropriate tariffs. So this has been particularly a problem for their enterprises with large infrastructure programs. In that regard, the PRC envisages a uniform framework for economic regulation being implemented by 2020 or 2025. An obvious question is what's going to happen until then. So if we recognize that regulators haven't always been making appropriate tariff determinations and consequences of those are having to be dealt with using other financing mechanisms, what's the interim process? I refer to the issue of competitive neutrality. There's a bit of tension, potentially, between competitive neutrality and the notion of the developmental space, and that needs to be reconciled. For particularly standing contingent on finance, the question of national treasury's plan to manage contingent liabilities over the medium-term expenditure framework, I think the DDG, Michael Sachs, made some reference to that in a previous meeting of Action Planning Committee on Appropriations, but something for this committee to follow up on. And the broader question of how Parliament can improve its oversight of the risks associated with these contingent liabilities. Another important question is whether the use of private capital can be reconciled with the reason for state ownership enterprises. So private capital is quite desirable in the current context because the state is finding itself pressed in terms of supporting SOE strategy, but is that compatible with the role that we expect these enterprises to play? Public private partnerships can spread out the burden of infrastructure financing, but they can also expose the state to significant risk, and they could be subject to greater parliamentary oversight. I think the important point here against the Parliament is that if, at whatever level, at the level of the executive or at the level of parliamentary committees, these indirect financing mechanisms are endorsed, there still needs to be some level of accountability. One imagines the Standing Committee on Finance in 10 years' time may have to deal with the consequences of public-private partnerships that went wrong. And in that sense, from a democratic accountability point of view, one wouldn't have to just neglect the process for determining these indirect financing mechanisms and their usage, just because they'll shift the burden to a later period. And then finally, which really links to that point, accountability and equity, the financial burden and financial risk of SOE funding, and this comes from the NDT, CRC reporting and special literature, should be distributed equity over generations. This is particularly important when it comes to the use of things like tariffs to finance infrastructure programs. What as a society we would presumably want to make sure of is that each generation pays an appropriate amount of infrastructure given the benefits they will receive from it and taking into account the economic growth. So we don't necessarily want the current generation to pay the entire cost of a piece of infrastructure that will actually benefit a future generation. That's probably considered the end. So these are the various issues that arise with indirect financing, but they're
A lot of the issues raised in the first half overlap with the issues raised here. Yes, Mr. Kali?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks, Sean. Sean, the
particular ones that are of concern to us. And then just a quick clarification on the question of explicit stunning. You seem to imply, when we were discussing slides 16 and 17, that this explicit stunning would just flow to an SOE. But surely this could also flow to a private enterprise as well.
Can you have 3 minutes at most to reply? And the rest you will give in writing. I think focus on those who didn't speak in the first half. I just want to make clear.
No, not your main question. We know that you have rather
the majority party, not least, is what exactly
shown up are very useful. How come there is a room for the private sector in the state or industry, apart from privatization, where they will also be benefits, but I don't have to be a full responsibility of their capital investments? So the issue isn't whether the private sector should participate in SOEs or not. It's the form it should take, the content of it, and the terms of it, like private-public partnerships and a variety of other ways. So for me, you know, I think Makosi put it very well. Linked to the first point that Tandy and Makosi both made. She said, I don't really agree with all of this. It's about operational efficiencies, really. Obviously, the issues of finance and rate are crucial. But ultimately, no matter how much money you get, it's how you manage the state owned entities, including the finances you have and you get. That's the premise. She spoke about governance, management, leadership, productivity, the will to do the right thing. And frankly, let me add, avoiding undue political interference and turning state owned entities into battle, political battles, actions, right? And using the state owned entity for purposes other than developmental, but political purposes too, right? So that's the problem. This is the problem that the chair and the portfolio issue were. How to avoid undue governmental and political interference in state-owned entities while having firm government and parliamentary oversight. That's a big challenge, really. And since she's an NEC member, hopefully she's in a better position to deal with some of these issues. NEC member, I'm talking about comrades before. Then I don't know what progress has been on the presidential review committee personally, and how this, you know, how comrades and other committees are dealing with that. I'll jump the other stuff. I also agree on the need for a definition of non-commercial that both the chair and Makosi raised. On the way forward, these are my own ideas. I bounced off the chair. Probably I think she agrees, but it's really the first thing I want to say is it seems to me that this report should be discussed in a fuller way by the public enterprises portfolio committee. Now, what you could do, committee chair, let us know when you're discussing it. What we can ask is for committee members, maybe two, one DA, one ANC, to go to that meeting. Secondly, what I would like to suggest is that you know that now we've done our work as the finance committee in this issue, going from the NGBPA. It's now for the state-owned enterprises committee to take this forward. So what I'd like to suggest here, President, is to let us know when you're looking at these issues again, so we can send people. Or if it falls in our lap, maybe on a Friday. We could call off in a meeting or not have a meeting on Friday. The Friday is on the agenda now, there's no choice. In some form or another, of course, it's longer hours. Can we discuss that later and next week Tuesday? So, what the options are we thinking about? I think maybe we should think about it. Those are ideas. There's no concrete resolution. If we just think it's fine, we can raise it next week. What I think is, see, we can't have this thing of endlessly, every time a financial issue comes up, committee members go, we must get involved. Well, that means with every committee, we will have to have joint meetings. So I'm fine for that. But now we have to allocate members. So maybe this can go to five of the other portfolio committees, mostly five of the other portfolio committees. That's my proposal, right? So we can look at e-money, we can look at nuclear, we can look at federal industry. So we will arrange for each member to be just five committees to go to. How will it be coming to them? We will have to focus on the work of finance, actually finance the rules and the norms of parliament. So we can have one VA, one opposition, and then each of them within five committees, they just go to those committees, and they must write reports on what they've got there. How about that, Charlie? On the issue of the shareholder compact, this is my main, on a more tedious note, the shareholder compact, I want to say something, this unapologetic, it is outrageous that the shareholder compact is not being made available. When Alec Earl was the minister, you can check the rules. We demanded the shareholder compact transfer. How are we supposed to monitor as parliament? Yeah, we got it. As far as I know, the shareholder management vote, because we're the majority party, Eric Irwin came to the party group three times for public enterprises. He took us through the whole thing. And to be, you know, to be fair to that company, what are you and others may think of it? Many of the proposals we had from the study group were put into the thing that there must be reports and blah, blah, but they can't even change the shareholder compact without bringing it to Parliament. Government can do it, but have to inform Parliament. We can have a say. So the final version of the bill here, there are a lot of them browsed under the bill, but when the bill was put out, it was very close to conclusion. He was hoping to pilot it before the 2009 term begins. But obviously, certain events occurred.
2007 in September, as you remember. And then in September 2008, certain things erect, which don't have none of you had anything to do with, and the early government stepped down. But his aim was to introduce it. So that bill was largely complete. And the study group of the ANC and the chair, I can tell you, a big hand in that bill. That bill made it clear. Shareholder contract, his view was, and I'm asking for the current minister, his view was, how do I get oversight beyond the department and myself as the minister? Right? And Parliament was doing, and his approach was that he had all those six proposals we made, he included in the bill. So he tied it because he wouldn't get away with it. Right? And the very last thing in the cabinet that I remember, the broad principles. So I don't know where that goes, but I'm not sure I've shared the contract from this before. It's outrageous. How are you supposed to buy these things private? This goes to another point. You wrote one letter to me. It's a very good link. You wrote a letter to me and said you're not getting cooperation. I then wrote a letter and then you said, fine, it's covered. So you should come back to me. Enter the chair, yeah. Because the information you are seeking for is in the public domain, but as you said, it's in different documents. So I'm not sure why you didn't come back to us, because we would have pushed for it. There's no debate about this. There's nothing to do with it. We have a right to this information, and we admit that you didn't get it. Then the final thing to say is, I would like to say, as much as I'm very appointed in you, Sean, I'm very disappointed in the coach here. You see, I thought you were going to sort out 2 million. I want that you tell me. One is from the precinct and one is from the KZN. I was going to show them how a chair changes and cut them down to size. So the next thing I meet, I say, you see, you saw the coach here, you failed dismally. You know what they do? One of them looked, now 22 minutes since you first had the speech, even if it's a unit, pipe down, man. How do I know you now? They carry on, man. The CA and the EFF are very well behaved in this community. I am hoping that you would manage the ANC side. So I'm very disappointed in the comrades, because now you've given the CA. But I must be sir, thank you very much, Deborah, and your members for coming. You can mull over some of the things we're proposing. But on a more serious note, when you do meet again, we would like to send some people all over the community to come. But it's in your hands, thank you very much.
Yeah, let me start by appreciating and thank you so much for initiating this kind of meeting and also the initiative to engage with Sean and his team about this, the whole thing of SOEs. What is important to us, we also learned a lot, not only you, we also learned a lot from the presentation, and we, as we propose, we go deep into the repository and engage as a community, so that they thoroughly understand. Where we don't understand, we will have to call them back again in the community to engage better with them. But critical for us, it will be, we need a way of re-engineering or re-capturing how we relate to the people and the community. Because it's for nothing. This thing of coming to us and presenting the court, we need to change that. Because they get away with it in more cases. And as long as we don't restart our relationship, we will end up doing better all the time. But we are very pleased and happy, and we would like to thank you for bringing all this information to us, though we could have engaged with you better on the report itself. Critical to us is to be the bill which is in the department now, which is trying to craft or managing this situation in our crisis. It's very critical. It has been taking a long time. And also the second one is the Presidential Review Committee report, which we are told to sign in the Department of Public Enterprise. And we also need your input around, you mentioned the models of this stable enterprise, but we also need your input so they can focus on, is this state-owned enterprise aligned to the National Development Plan and also our pronouncement of the state of the developmental things? I'll give an example. ESO is like CNN. You look into how they operate. Their mandate in the past was to manufacture weapons or whatever, ammunition, to send the past, and also because they were not able to do business with the world. So if this structure in that manner, and we wonder how should we help them turn around. Governing of them who has not yet really died. So in the next meeting, we will bring our the time is here, we'll be able to specify on which area we want you to come and present to us in relation to the presentation to the committee. Please see if you've been able to catch that. And without wasting our time, I thank you so much and the honorable members from the other committee of presidents, my fellow colleagues and colleagues, William C. Comrade. I think there was no way I could have done it. I'm scared of them. On that note, we like to thank you very much, and we are looking forward to see you in the near future. Okay, in the near future, we'll also bring transport and energy to this presentation.
Before you pass, something I'd just like to alert you, which you don't know. In the 2004-2009 period, the minister of the time, and the government continues to set like a framework for common promises and payments of state-owned entities, managers. I don't know where that process is, but I think allegedly that started in the PD Norman's chairing that committee. To finance the finance committee, can you say for a few minutes, I've distributed to you 13 areas. You can now there's a 14 before we're prepared, right? So can you look at the thing? Unfortunately, because Alan is on leave for a few days, and because Cindy can look at that thing. Very quickly, apart from the carbon tax bill, finance intelligence amendment bill, what other bill are you hoping to table again? Look at numbers 11 and 12. Sorry, that's fine. Please speak to the mic.
The document that I circulated, there is median, the others are median, and it's on the high, and these keep for one of the short.
Yeah, but the November was falling to the next calendar.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Rather sitting for extra time, 27th of September, usually it ends on 14th of November, we're sitting on 27th of November now, right? Then what we have to do is ask for an extra week or something. But I will discuss this all with the powers that be in the committee section. We're having a shared meeting. But we will probably have to sit a week or two, I don't know how long, after the 27th of September. We need to look at times. We need to start earlier and end later on the day, and Wednesday, September 3, and so on. So I think we need to be realistic about what we can and cannot do. And we're not going to be pushed by National Trade Unity. We'll do what we can. The local government election coming early next year will be very busy and so on. But we'll try to do what we can. So in short, take comment on this, and before we suggest endless meetings with other committees, think about what's practicable. I do what I'm required to do, but I don't agree with it. I'll let it report to you. I have gone to the chairperson of energy, and said this issue keeps coming up across the political party divide. What are the financial implications of the nuclear procurement and so on? He says they're also preoccupied with that. It's now been agreed that his committee will lead the process, because the issue is, what is the role of nuclear in the context of energy as a whole? And then we look at the financial implications and we look at how it's being funded. So his committee will lead that. That's why I haven't got it here. If his committee is going to tell us when they need to meet. And I'll suggest to him that he will speak, as I said before, now the chairperson of here. Maybe they come in as well. And this will remind the Association Committee. Maybe they can come in as well. So I will speak again to Mr. Majola from the Majola team today. And suggest maybe appropriations there. That's right. Appropriate. So four committees should meet. So it's a policy issue with financial implications. The policy does not belong to us. Belong to state. But what we could do, and I'm more serious about it, we could actually also deploy on certain big issues two people, one opposition, one ANC, to go to those committee meetings. So on public enterprises, we need two names. DA one name and so on to go to a meeting. I don't think we're supposed to have another joint meeting. And on nuclear, we need somebody to from the ANC side, one from the opposition, it could be ASF, whoever, goes to the meetings. After the first meeting of all four committees, I don't think we can meet in this year. But I want them to apply their mind and be realistic, because if we're going to start earlier, people have to be on time. Maybe a compromise is sit from 9:30 to 13:30 in future. Another option I think about is we sit every Friday or the alternate Friday. Previously, college class after hours to avoid sitting on Fridays, the village turned up and set the chair and one of the members, usually the opposition, the mentality, just to be battled to sit, so we sit on Friday. So I'm cool. It's just that people have got a lot of ideas without looking at the very people that propose religious resolve.
Oh, now you want to go.